All right, well, good morning. Before we jump into our teaching, let me give you one quick announcement, and that is that this Tuesday we are starting a series of what we call Leadership Connections. And we do this each fall semester and spring semester where we have four Tuesdays, every other Tuesday, where we invite people to come together and talk about just ideas that we think are pretty central to the church. And this is specifically designed for leaders, if there's a small group leader or ministry leader here, getting on the same page and really envisioning for the upcoming season, but it is something that's open to everybody. And so if you just want to think through how to help shape this church, we would invite you to come to our Leadership Connections 7 to 8:30 starting this Tuesday right here in the church lobby. So join us then. Okay, so last week, Travis gave a teaching, and within that teaching was the most important message you'll ever hear. And that is what we call the gospel. It's the good news. It's the good news of the message of what God has done through Jesus. It's how God made a way to bring his enemies, those who had rejected, betrayed, insulted him, you and me, to bring those enemies into his family, to adopt them, and to give them the opportunity to experience his eternal love forever. And that's what we call the gospel message. And obviously, it's such a central message. And when we hear it, it should stir something inside of us, even if it's something that we've heard thousands of times, if it's something that we received decades ago, it still should stir something in us. And it should stir this great love for God and this longing for him, this deep desire, this deep affection for God. I like how the psalmists describe this longing. In Psalm 42, as a deer pants for flowing streams, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? Or Psalm 63, verse 1, O God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you, my flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water. And when we get a glimpse of God, and perhaps especially when we understand freshly even his gospel message, it stirs this kind of longing where we earnestly seek him. And that's what we want to do here. Every time we gather together, to earnestly seek God, because we see God as central. We center ourselves as on God. He is what matters. He is what we seek. Everything else pales in comparison to him. Everything is considered loss compared to knowing God. What is most critical is this vertical relationship that we have with God. And yet, when you read through the Bible, sometimes it is uncomfortably horizontal. Okay, where it seems to give this priority to our horizontal relationships among each other in a way that almost makes you uncomfortable when you're trying to make God central. So, for example, 1 Thessalonians 2:19 and 20 says, "For what is our hope? Or joy, or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming, is it not you? For you, these people, these Thessalonians, you are our glory and joy." And it seems like when we read that the Apostle Paul is using words, assigning words to people that should be reserved for God. And we see this in many places in the New Testament, where these kinds of things are found in people, joy, hope, glory, life, our crown of boasting. And again, we feel like, are we really supposed to say those things or think those things, that we find our joy and our hope in people? Well, in some sense, yes. And the answer is yes, because our relationship with God is so intertwined with our relationships with each other. They're just inseparable. We can't really have one without the other. They feed off of each other. That's why it says this in 1 John, this uncomfortable verse, a couple of verses. It says, if anyone says, I love God and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And this commandment we have from him, whoever loves God must also love his brother. We again see just how necessarily intertwined our relationships with each other are with our relationship with God. And if we're really all about God and seeking him and making him first, that must include each other. And that's true because of God's fundamental nature. Fundamentally, God is relational, and in the Christian faith, we believe this wild, mysterious truth that God is triune, that there are three distinct persons within the Godhead, and yet they are perfectly united. And so we know that fundamentally, God is relational, and he's created his people to be relational as well, to experience him through relationship because he is fundamentally relational. And so our horizontal relationships are vitally important to our relationship with God because he's made us in his image fundamentally relational. So with that in mind, we are going to talk today, like Travis mentioned, about the church. And if you're new with us, we are in the middle of a six-week series on church membership. And church membership, like formally becoming a part of a church, is something that we have done really throughout our history. We've offered that as a church. And we used to regularly have a membership class where we would give people that opportunity to commit formally as church members. And yet, that membership class was a little bit of a casualty of COVID. And so over that COVID season, we stopped doing that membership class, and we hadn't yet resurrected it. But in the back of our minds, we always wanted to. We just wanted to get to a point where we could revamp a little of the material and then restart that up. And we're finally getting to that. But since it's been over 6 years, we just wanted to take the whole church through it. And so that's what we're doing. And the first week, Perry took us through this just introductory question, why membership? And just asked, okay, why should we even think about this kind of thing? Like becoming a formal member of a church. And then last week, Travis answered this question, what is a Christian? Of course, that is pretty important. If you're going to be a member of a Christian church, you have to ask first, what is a Christian? Maybe that's the most important question. But we're going to continue to narrow a little bit as we go through these weeks. Now, after answering what is a Christian, we're going to say, okay, what does that mean for a group of Christians? What is the church? We're going to try to answer that question this morning, and then we'll keep narrowing next week. Where does some of you fit when we think about the universal church? What slice of the church does some of you occupy? What are some of you's distinctives, or its history, or where do we land? Where do we fall on certain things? And then continuing to narrow, who is some of you? We'll get into some of our vision, our core values, and try to describe some of what flavors who we are. And then we'll continue to do that the sixth week, but maybe take a little bit of a turn viewing outwardly what we do as a church. So that's where we're going. With that in mind, I wanted to again mention something that we are offering that really complements this series, and that is connection groups. And so as we went through this membership material, we wanted to give people an opportunity to interact on it more personally, specifically those that are a little newer to the church. So if you feel like you are newer, maybe in the last few weeks or months or even last couple of years, and you're just getting to know some of you, want to get to know some of you more and see where your place might be, I would really encourage you to join one of these groups. And so we'll have one right after the church service starting at 11:30 in room 221, which is just up the lobby staircase. You take a right down a short hallway, it's in room 221. Lunch and childcare are provided for that. And we invite you, even if you miss the first 2 weeks, Okay, there's a little bit of a process here. We're building on each other, and yet each one of these weeks is pretty standalone as well. And so if you missed the first 2 weeks, please come this week just to be able to meet some people and, again, interact on this material. There's also another opportunity on Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. right here in the lobby. So please consider joining one of those. All right, well, let's get to our question. What is the church? Okay, what is the church? Well, the church is the building. I'm seeing if you guys are awake here. Church is actually not the building. Church is something else. And we want to try to understand what is the church. Well, let's start with just the word used. The word used in the New Testament. And that word is ecclesia. Ecclesia, you may have heard that word before. That's the word that is typically translated church in the New Testament. You may have heard the word ecclesiology. That's really just your doctrine of the church, although most people probably don't have a very well-defined ecclesiology. That's what we're trying to build a little bit this morning, although we're just going to scratch the surface. But ecclesia, sort of a combination of two words, ek and kaleo, out of and to call. So literally, it means called out ones, but was often used in ancient Greece to refer to a public assembly of citizens or a group gathered for a purpose. Okay, so this word was used for this kind of assembly, this sort of gathering. Literally means called out ones. The New Testament adopts this word to refer to Christians. It's talking about Christians. It also probably references an Old Testament word that was used for assembly. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the word is that is used for assembly is actually ecclesia in Greek. And so it's talking about this assembly of Christians. But the question is church just the plural of Christian? Is that what it means? That church is plural for Christian, Christians. And that's really the most minimalistic definition. It's just Christians. That's what the church is. And so you can experience church in all kinds of situations. You can experience church at Starbucks with a friend, talking over coffee about Jesus. Two Christians getting together, that could be an expression of church. You could have an expression of church going for a hike, experiencing God in nature, maybe with another believer, and that is church. You could say that, but I want to ask the question, is that church? I want to say, well, maybe. Let's think about it a little bit more. Here's what I want to say. I'm going to use, since it is Super Bowl Sunday, I'm going to use a football analogy here. And so we have our football players. These guys are from just down the street at Rocky. I'm going to say that Christians, a Christian is like a football player. Okay, and here's how. A football player, when I say I am a football player, I am taking on this individual personal identity as I'm a football player. And yet, if I take on that individual identity, it basically demands a corporate identity. You actually can't be a football player alone. Okay, that's just not how the activity works. Other activities do work like that. I can say I'm a runner, I'm a bodybuilder, I'm a skier, and I can sort of do those alone. But you can't play football alone. And so the personal individual identity demands this corporate identity, and I want to say that a Christian is similar. Okay, that when I call myself a Christian, it is also referring to a corporate identity and a way of interacting with other Christians, just like a football player demands some sort of interaction with other football players, demands a team, and it demands certain rules and a certain way of going about things and a certain kind of partnership. And I think that's what a Christian demands as well. Now, that pushes against, when we start to think about our Christianity in this way, it can push against our Western individualism that we have all been equipped with. I remember when I first came to Christ as a college student, of course, there's a large emphasis on your personal relationship with Christ, as there should be, because it was communicated to me that it's not just the family that you're born into or certain patterns that you walk through, just like Travis explained last week. There's actually this personal embracing of faith. And so there is a personal relationship with Jesus, but of course it's easy for us to take it way too far and think it's only about that individual, very personal relationship with Jesus, and it's so much more. And so we need to keep asking, okay, what is necessary, say, for a football player to be a football player in terms of the partnership with others? Similarly, we can ask that about Christians. What's necessary to form a church? Is church, say, going to Starbucks with a friend or going on that hike? Well, I'm going to say it could be. That could be doing church, but only if there are other things going on as well. Only if it's in the context of something else where other things are happening. If so, then that hike can be an expression of church. Again, it's like the football player. If I'm running, can I say I'm playing football? And the answer is, well, it depends. If I'm just running, I'm probably not playing football. But running is necessary for football. It's going to be a part of football if other things are happening as well. Okay, if there are plays that are called and there's formations and blocking and catching and carrying this ball, then running is a part of football. And similarly, going to Starbucks with a friend may be doing church if there are some other things involved as well. Okay, so let's try to flesh this out and understand what the church is. Now, when the word church or ecclesia is used in the New Testament, of course, it can be referring to two different types of church, you could say. One is what we often call the big C, or universal church. This is all believers, all Christians. So Colossians 1, 17 and 18 says, "And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent." And so, if Christ is your head, you're a part of the church. So on one hand, the church is all Christians. That's the universal big C church. And so I have this brotherhood, this affinity for everybody in the world who is a Christian. And I've experienced that even when I've traveled internationally and met other believers from China or Costa Rica or Spain, and there is an immediate bond. And there's just common experiences and this common love for Jesus that does bond us together because we're a part of the church. But in addition, there is what we often refer to as the little c, or the local church. And most of the instances in the New Testament when the word church is used, it is referring to a local church. Even though the word local is not used there, it's referring to a specific defined group of people in some locality. And that's usually how the word church is used. So, for example, 1 Corinthians 1:2, to the church of God that is in Corinth. Or Philippians 4:15, you Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving except you only. Obviously, he's saying there are multiple churches. You are one church. There are other churches out there. Or similarly in Colossians, give my greetings to the brothers at Laodicea and to Nympha and the church in her house. Okay, so there's a church that meets in her house. And when this letter has been read among you, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans, and see that you also read the letter from Laodicea. So, there's this indication in the New Testament that a church is a defined group of people, at least in some instances of the usage of the word. It's a specific group of people. It's a local church. And so we ask the question, is it important or even necessary to be integrated into a local church? And I am going to try to make the case for what we call the local church here and the importance of it and the importance of really uniting yourself with a local church. Now, I could do that in a lot of different ways. I think I could look at particular commands in the Bible. We could look at some church history. But what I'm going to do for most of today is just look at three metaphors that are used in the New Testament to describe the church. And I think this can be helpful, you know, looking at these kinds of word pictures. These word pictures are all over the Bible, for one. It's sort of it's an Eastern, maybe Middle Eastern or even Jewish thing to use these kinds of images, these metaphors, these word pictures to communicate truth. And when we see it, it helps that truth to really sink down and helps us to understand things that maybe we wouldn't have otherwise. And so as the Bible uses these metaphors, it paints us a picture of the church. What's involved in the church? What are those necessary components of the church? Kind of a baseline level of activity that might constitute a church. Just like in football, there are baseline components of the game, of the activity that define it, that make it football. So let's look at each one of these. We're going to start with family. So oftentimes the church is called family. Let's start with the Lord's Prayer. So Jesus' disciples had asked him to teach them how to pray. And so he does, and he gives them this template prayer that we've called the Lord's Prayer. And it's so interesting that the first word of the Lord's Prayer recognizes this family nature of the church. Okay, as we're praying to God, again, as we're coming before him and engaging in that vertical relationship with God, the first word in Jesus' template prayer is our Father. And when we're acknowledging our Heavenly Father, at the same time, we're acknowledging our siblings. And then the prayer continues to use us and our and we. We're seeking God, but we're doing it together, and we're doing it as a family. And so we see this brothers and sisters language throughout the New Testament. Again, I remember when I first came into the church, and I'd hear people refer to each other as brother or sister, and I'd be confused. Like, they don't look like each other. But they were expressing something that is expressed in the New Testament, that we are brothers and sisters, we're part of a family. So what is implied through the use of family? Okay, what is God trying to get across with this picture of the church? What do we think of when we think of a family? Well, I'm going to give you three characteristics of a family, and then I'll do the same for body and army. The first one of a family is simple togetherness. It's just togetherness. As families, we tend to be together a lot. So those in my family, those are the people that I see the most. By far, they're the ones that I spend the most time with. Now, some families struggle with that more, but we're talking about what were the intentions for the family. You know, we have examples of families that are not ideal, but what is the original intention? And I would say togetherness would certainly be one. And so it's that Hebrews 10 kind of, let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing. The church, like a family, just experiences togetherness. There's a quantity of time there where we're just with each other. We're together. And we, because of that quantity of time, we can live out much of what is instructed of us in the Bible, all those one another commands, which there are dozens of them, love one another, serve one another, show hospitality to one another. We are invited to pursue those, but it just takes a togetherness. And so as families, as the family of God, we are simply together. Secondly, there's understanding, and by this I mean knowing each other. Okay, there's a knowing of others, and there's a being known. And of course, we experience that in families. I know those in my family really well, and they know me, and we know all of our strengths and weaknesses and our little quirks. You just know those things about each other because you experience all that time with each other. And you could describe things about them that nobody else could describe because you just know each other. You understand each other well. So there's a knowing, an understanding. And then, of course, there's an affection. There's an affection. Even if you feel like I don't get along with my siblings that well, you still have this great affection for them, this deep affection. And as the church, we have a similar affection. You know, another metaphor that is used to describe the church is the bride of Christ. And that's specifically communicating the affection that Jesus has for the church. But if Jesus has that affection, then shouldn't we as well? There's just a love for, an appreciation of the church. There's probably a refraining from an overly critical spirit of fellow believers. There's probably even a desire to defend, just like we do our siblings, for example. Okay, you might kind of spar with your siblings, but if somebody criticizes your brother or sister, there's something that rises up in you. Because you have that affection, you have that appreciation for them. Perhaps a good litmus test for whether or not this affection is really flowing like God intends it to be is just through an examination of thanksgiving for others in your lives. We just taught through Philippians not too long ago here on Sunday mornings, and the book starts like this. It says, I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you. And in most of Paul's epistles, he starts with something like this. I'm just always thanking God for you. So grateful for you individuals, like he's thinking of people by name and face. And he's just always thanking God for them. There is this grateful appreciation that just flows out of somebody, an appreciation, a great gratitude for their family. And so we can see, in the New Testament, when it refers to us, the church, as family, we can expect that there is going to be a togetherness, an understanding, and an affection. Let's go to body. Okay, what is implied by body? Well, let's go to a few passages. First, we'll start in 1 Corinthians 12. This is the chapter that really emphasizes the church as body. And I'll read a few verses from it. It says, for just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. Then a little later, if the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And what do we see here? Well, I think we see, I'm just going to call it appreciation. And there's an appreciation for each member of the body in a few different ways. You know, with our bodies, we appreciate each part. And there's a value there. And in 1 Corinthians 12, it addresses probably two errors. One is the error of pride, where the eye says to the foot, I don't really need you, foot. And we, you know, we look down on certain expressions of the body. The other error is where the foot says, because I'm not an eye, I don't really belong to the body. Where certain members of the body feel like they're not really needed. But this whole metaphor communicates that no, every part of the body is essential, and there's a deep appreciation that we have for every part. And so if there's a Christian that is not connected to the church, not integrated into the church, there's a disservice being done because you're not bringing this essential part of God's design, how he designed you to fill a hole in the church. So there is an appreciation for every part of the body in the church. Secondly, we can go a little further into 1 Corinthians 12. It says, but God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. So there's just deep care. The parts of the body care for each other. And I hope you have experienced this. I think I experienced it just yesterday where my wife and I got together with some dear friends, and they had received some challenging news. And there's a care, there's a burden carrying that happens together. Because if one part of the body hurts, we all hurt. And if one part rejoices, we all rejoice. And the implication is that we are to be integrated enough in the church that we feel that. Okay, that when we have that burden, there are people rallying around to carry that burden, and vice versa. There's just a deep care. We all rejoice together, and we all go through these challenges together. There is a care. Let's read another passage that speaks of the body in Ephesians 4, 15 and 16. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and held together by every joint with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. Okay, and we see that Christ works in his church, he causes it to grow, and yet it happens as each part is working. Each part is filling that role that it was designed to fill, and it's connected together by every joint. And we see that we are in some way dependent on each other for our growth. Okay, we grow together, we grow collectively. And we see that in body. You know, it's not like my big toe grows really big and the rest of me stays the same. You know, it's like each part sort of grows together. And there's little variations, maybe you have bigger ears or whatever, but you all grow together. Each part of the body grows together. Like you're sort of dependent on each other. And so there is this interdependency in the body. We all grow together. We need to be connected in there. We support each other. We all grow collectively. Okay, let's go on to the army. There are several places in the New Testament where believers are referred to as fellow soldiers. And this is how it's written. We are our fellow soldiers together, and so we are in some way a part of an army. Now, what is implied through the term army? Well, first of all, there's just an identification, a kind of an alignment with fellow soldiers. It's putting on that uniform. It's again, aligning and identifying yourself with your fellow soldiers. And I wanted to take this opportunity to talk a little bit about baptism. Now, baptism is publicly identifying with Christ after coming to belief in him. And so when you're part of this team, this army, upon entering, you identify yourself. You identify yourself publicly. We often use the analogy of a wedding ring to describe baptism, that when you put on a wedding ring, it is identifying yourself as being bound together with this other person. And and it's for all to see. And it didn't make you married when you just put on a ring, or if I took off this ring, it wouldn't make me unmarried. But it is a symbol that says I am married. And it would be strange if I walked into some social situation and just took off my ring and put it in my pocket. Okay, that would be communicating something. No, this symbol is it remains in order to tell the world something about how I am identifying, who I am united with. Or, continuing the football analogy, it is putting on the jersey. You put on the jersey so you are identifying with this team. And baptism is very similar. It's publicly identifying, it's proclaiming, I am with Jesus and I'm with his people. And it's this picture of going down and coming back up where it illustrates Christ's death and then his resurrection, and it illustrates the new life that we're stepping into. But it's declaring that. And so, as we're talking about membership, church membership, membership in some of you, we ask that everybody is biblically baptized. That doesn't mean that you are baptized in this church necessarily, but it does mean that after coming to belief, you have chosen to identify yourself with Jesus at some point by baptism. So in this army, we identify ourselves through baptism and through other means with Jesus and with his people. But also through the word army, of course, mission is implied. There's this shared mission that we are doing together, and we need each other, of course, desperately, as we unite in this common purpose. And this is going to involve a lot. It is going to involve our marching orders, which is biblical teaching. We need to hear from our King, Jesus. And of course, he has spoken to us through this book. And so we need to come together and we need to hear from him. And so teaching is important, and shepherding and discipleship and certain levels of authority and sacrifice is a part of this. As we engage in this mission together, we are bringing ourselves and we're laying ourselves down. And so there's this mission component that we unite under as we pursue this endeavor together. And so there is mission and everything that is involved in that. And then thirdly and finally, there's just what I'm going to call organization. There's some sort of arrangement, some division of labor. There's authority and so forth, and there's delegation. Now this, I think if we think about it, it can be difficult for us when it comes to church due to a natural aversion towards this kind of thing, towards organization. And we can develop this kind of dichotomy in our minds. And I mentioned this briefly a few weeks ago, but I want to tease it out a little bit more. Sometimes we can develop this kind of thinking in our mind. There are good things to pursue, and we label those, we pursue them organically. Like we want the church to flow organically. And then there are other things that are more institutional. Okay, they're the institutional components of the church, and those are bad. And we kind of pit these against each other. And so we have the good organic things that involve informality and spontaneity and equality and expression and openness and authenticity. And there's these bad things, the institutional things, structures and systems and authority and formality and regularity and uniformity. And of course, we want one and not the other. But I think we need to check that impulse a little bit and make sure that we are approaching our view of church in a balanced way and in a biblical way. And I want to defend that institutional part a little bit, and I want to do that by going to Acts chapter 6, and you can actually open up Acts 6 with me. It's on page 914 in your house Bible. And I'm going to read verses 1 through 7, and this is when, in the early church, what we would call deacons are appointed. There are these seven deacons. They're appointed for a specific task to carry out in the church. So I'm going to read it. Now, in these days, when the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint by the Hellenists arose against the Hebrews because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution. And the 12 summoned the full number of the disciples and said, "It is not right that we should give up preaching the word of God to serve tables. Therefore, brothers, pick out from among you 7 men of good repute, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we will appoint to this duty. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word." And what they said pleased the whole gathering, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and the Holy Spirit, and Philip, and Prochorus, and Nicanor, and all these guys. These they set before the apostles, and they prayed and laid their hands on them. And the word of God continued to increase, and the number of the disciples multiplied greatly in Jerusalem, and a great many of the priests became obedient to the faith. So what we see here is that in the early church, an office was developed. A layer of structure was implemented here. There's certain authority given. There's task, a little bit of procedure here. And they did it in order to meet a critical need that was being neglected. And that's what happened. And I think this, of course, is going to happen a lot, where there is going to be some gap. There's going to be some hole in the church, and often some kind of organization is needed to be able to fill that hole. It's sort of like this. I'll tell you a little about myself. I am old. Okay, so I'm old, and I'll tell you why I think that. There's a difference between a young person and an old person. And a young person hears some important piece of information, and the young person assumes, "I'll remember that." But an old person hears an important piece of information, and they say, "There is no way I'm going to remember that unless I write it down. Like, unless I get it into my phone, my task list, my calendar, my notes app. In the next 7 seconds, I'm not going to remember that." And the young person, again, they think, "I'm going to remember that. There's no problem." They hear about an important engagement or a name or the title of a book or something. They say, "I'll remember that." And oftentimes they do. But I have come to the point where I say, there's no way I'm going to remember that unless I get it. Again, I take out my phone and I get it in there. Even though I would say it's important to me, I'm not going to remember it because I recognize some weakness in myself. I recognize some lack of capacity. And I need to sort of create some kind of system in order to make sure I pursue the values that I think I need to pursue. And the same thing happened here in Acts chapter 6. They came together. They were this thriving early church. The Spirit was moving in these powerful ways. And yet, even though they were living out organically the Christian life, they still had a blind spot, or they had some area that they were prone to neglect. And if you asked them, they would have all said, "Yeah, we value taking care of every widow." And yet, in reality, they didn't, because there was a lack in them. And sometimes when we think we can just do everything, again, just very organically, perhaps it's an overestimation of our own sanctification, where we think a little too highly of what will naturally flow out of us. And sometimes we say, "No, I think we need to create some sort of order here in order to make sure the really important things are being taken care of." And so these guys created the office of deacon. And likewise, we create certain levels of organization in order to address things that need to be addressed. And so I'm so glad that we have deacons to take care of similar needs. I'm so glad that we have a prayer team that is focused on prayer. I am so glad we have people to think about finances or whatever it might be. We have added certain systems and structures and organization in order to hopefully pursue the values that we have. Now, of course, we all know that we can overstructure. We've all been victims of that, and we need to make sure that we keep it within bounds and recognize our tendency to just build and build and build these structures that actually do hinder some of the spiritual life of the church. But we shouldn't immediately think poorly of those kinds of things. There is some sort of organization that is probably necessary for a church. So we have these three metaphors, family, body, and army, and they are supposed to communicate something. And they communicate, I think, key components of what is necessary in a church. So we ask ourselves, what is the church? Well, we could say the church is Christians experiencing all of these things. Christians experiencing togetherness, just together. We know each other, we understand each other. There's a deep affection and a gratitude for each other. We appreciate each part of the body and highly esteem those parts of the body that might not naturally be esteemed. We care for each other deeply, carry each other's burdens. There is this interdependency where we rely on each other. No one person does everything, but the church works together as a body. We identify with our King Jesus together. We have this common purpose that we seek, and we receive our marching orders from Jesus through his Bible, and we unite together and seek him together, and we organize that in some way that allows us to pursue all the values that we have, and that is a church. That's a church when these things are happening. And sometimes that happens at Starbucks. Sometimes that happens on the hike. But it also happens here. And it happens in lots of different places. But together, they all contribute to forming a church. Now, you may look at that list and you think, I'm not there. Okay, maybe you're not experiencing a lot of those things. I think that's okay. This is a target. Okay, we're trying to define church and say, this is what we're shooting for. And the invitation is to take a step further in, to try to pursue these kinds of things more and more. Now, some of us, of course, have been hurt by the church. Sometimes you play football and you tear your ACL. Or you get berated by a coach, and it turns you off to the game of football. And that happens in the church as well. And we could talk a lot about that. I'm not going to go into depth, but I just want to say that just because there is a broken experience of that is experienced in the game of football does not mean that football is to be rejected. And similarly, we will experience, just like Travis was describing earlier, we will experience heartache in the church. But if we remove ourselves from the experience of all these things, we are removing ourselves from the potential to experience God in all his fullness. Because again, he made us very relational. And we see him as we experience these things. So, what is the church? It is all of these things. As we move along, next week we're going to talk about where does some of you fit. And let's keep talking about football here. Okay, let's go back to these guys. So there are certain features that must be present for a football game, a football player. But there still are going to be different expressions of the game. And so when one of these guys graduates from high school and he thinks, I want to play college football, he is going to consider his options. And he's going to consider the style of play at a given school. And he's going to consider the coaching staff and how he may fit in the offense. And those things are going to be considered. Well, next week when we ask the question, where does some of you fit, we're going to try to describe, okay, what is our offense? Okay, what is our makeup? What slice do we fill in the universal church? We'll talk about denominations. We'll talk about evangelicalism. We'll talk about those kinds of things so that we can all understand, okay, this is where some of you fits in the universal church. And so please join us again next week as we continue to narrow. But now we're going to transition a little bit. And Brayton, I'd like to invite you up so you can lead us a little bit here. But we are going to participate in communion together, and I think this is very fitting. Earlier I talked about baptism and this ordinance that was given to us to identify with Jesus. Well, this is another ordinance, and it's one that I think we are given to do together. And I want to read part of a passage in 1 Corinthians 11 that describes this. 1 Corinthians 11, 23 through 29. This is Paul describing breaking of bread together. Now, prior to this passage, he had really pretty strongly rebuked the Corinthians for gathering in a dishonoring way and not really considering each other as they broke bread and experienced communion together. But then he says this, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way also he took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" So there's this command from Jesus to do this with regularity, where we eat the bread and drink from the cup in order to remember his death, his body and his blood being poured out for us. And so the church was intended to gather. This is another feature of the church. Okay, if we're going to say, what is a church? Well, I think this is part of it also. There's this regular participation in this. But it's also a thing that we do together. I want to keep reading the next few verses of this passage. He continues his rebuke. He says, "Whoever therefore eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty concerning the body and blood of the Lord. Let a person examine himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself." And I want to talk about just that last verse really quickly. When he says, without discerning the body, there are various opinions of what that means. Is he talking about the body of Christ and the bread that represents that body? Well, he could be. But it is interesting that he doesn't say discerning the body and the blood. He just says body here. And many think that he's probably just referring to the church as the body. And so there's a discernment of the body, the church, as we participate in this together. And I think what is indicated is that this taking of communion was to be, again, a very corporate communal thing where we are remembering Jesus, but we're doing it together. We're remembering him as one. And so this is a very important part of being the church, is taking communion together. And so we're going to do that right now. Now, this is, of course, for those who belong to the universal church. So if you become a Christian, you've identified yourself as being one with Jesus, then this is something that he invites you to do and to do it regularly. And so for those of you that have not yet come to that point, we would just invite you to remain in your pew, but you can consider, is this something that you would, if you would like to identify yourself with Jesus? And it just really takes a simple prayer of saying, "Yes, Jesus, I receive your grace." And then you can join us at this table. But we're going to do this right now, and how we'll do it is we will divide the room down the center, and we will exit to the outsides and then come back in the middle, and you can take the bread and the cup with you here from the table. There are also gluten-free options at each table. And then you can come back to your seat and just again reflect on and thank God for what he did through Jesus and also the church that he called you into. And to discern the body, to recognize that we are one seeking him together. So first rows can come down and take the elements and take them back to your seat, reflect on that with God, and then you can take them when you see fit.